All right, so we're gonna get started. So there are a couple of faces here that are new. So let me just spend literally a minute and a half just recapping a little bit of what we spoke about yesterday. We introduced that the Rambam, Maimonides, is known probably most famously for his magnus opus. I'm reminded that everyone should please put theirs on mute. But his magnum opus was the Mishneh Torah, which was the halacha compendium that really comprised everything regarding Jewish law. But as we mentioned, from age 23 till age 30, when he did a lot of traveling, moving from Spain, ultimately finding his way into Egypt, he comprised and he composed these 13 principles of faith as part of his commentary on the Mishnah. Now, again, just wanted to point out that he was not doing anything heretical. He was not suggesting that all 613 commandments that comprise the totality of our Torah should just be boiled down to 13 things. But rather, he understood it, and we explained it as parts of the body. There are certain, every organ in the body, every limb, every vein and sinew, everything is critically important. However, certain organs are so vital to the entire existence of the person that they are in a different category. They're beyond essential. They're critical. And these 13 principles, Maimonides identified and said that these are the 13 principles upon which the Jewish faith is based and are the critical components in terms of one's relationship to Judaism. So we started with the first principle, and I'll at the end of the class, I'll send the link again. This time I'll get it right, hopefully the first time. Of where you can use this, the source sheet. But we said that the first one, Animamin Be'emuna Shelema, I believe with complete faith, Shehabore Yisbarach Shemo, that the Creator, blessed is His name, creates and guides all creatures, and that He alone made, makes, and will make everything. And we broke it down into three components. Very simply put, number one, I say that simply, obviously, in quotes, right? Number one is that there is a God who exists. That's number one. Number two, or the second aspect, is this being brought everything into existence. And the third is that it's the source for everything's continued existence. Anything that ever was, is, or will be created is only because God wills it to be. And we talked yesterday about the concept that God's existence is absolute. It's not dependent on anyone or on anything. It is completely independent source. It was not brought into being or into existence by anything or anyone. This is already alluded to in the very first of what we call the Ten Commandments about Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God. I exist. Now, we left off yesterday. Even if we just accept it at face value, we're challenged. How do we know God exists? Listen, we are human beings. We have five senses. That's all we have. Some of us even lack some of those. But we have the basic five senses, none of which I can't see, I can't touch, I can't hear, I can't taste, I can't smell God. So how do I know it exists? Everything else in my world, I'm able to identify and to say it exists because I can use one of my senses. I can see something, I can hear something, perhaps taste it or smell it. How do we apply this to God? The answer is, I don't know. The answer is that, yes, there's a certain level of a quote understanding, but here's the important line, and I wish we were in person, because some of my Shoresh teens here can testify that I love to use what's called the nail trick. And I challenge them. I hand them a little block of wood with a nail sticking on top of it. And then I hand them 12 additional nails. And I challenge them to balance all 12 nails on the head, on the head of that nail sticking in the piece of wood. And they go about and they try, and everywhere, ultimately, after a period of time, they say, I don't know, it's impossible. You're giving us this exercise so that we'd understand that there are certain things that we just can't do. And then I smile and I show them that it can be done. And the important lesson that I try to share, and this is something that you're going to want to remember, the incomprehensibility of something does not necessarily negate the possibility of its existence. Simply put, Just because you can't comprehend it doesn't mean it's not there. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. As human beings, we are limited. Yes, we have incredible, incredible abilities. But at the end of the day, we are limited. We are physically limited. We are emotionally limited. We are limited in every capacity because we are finite and we are physical human beings. There are certain things that are beyond our comprehension. We don't have all the tools necessary to measure. If I were to go ahead and try to measure the number of people on the Zoom call using a Richter scale, it wouldn't work because a Richter scale doesn't measure people, doesn't measure the number of people on the call. It measures the strength of an earthquake. You have to have the right tools. Human beings don't have necessarily the tool of the five senses we know to measure something out of our realm. But just because I can't directly approach it because I don't have a sense doesn't mean I can't find indirect ways. And this is what many, many commentaries try to do. Many philosophical works of Judaism, they grapple with this question. And many of them come up with an indirect approach. I'll give you a couple of examples. We know anyone who's ever been in a nice, beautiful building or sees a beautiful structure, looks at it and takes almost a breath and says, wow, the design of this building is stunning. It's amazing. The person next to him says, yeah, but it's pretty random. I mean, how do you know anyone actually built it? Maybe it just fell this way. Someone took a pile of brick and a pile of mortar, threw it up in the air, and it formed this beautiful building. Now, the answer is it might be. There is a mathematical possibility that that is, in fact, what happened. But the likelihood gets less and less. The more you recognize the design of an architect, the fact that windows are placed in a strategic location, the fact that you can build skyscrapers certain distance, height, that you can go ahead and you look at it, how everything fits just perfectly, you say it's possible, but the likelihood gets less and less and less the more you recognize the design. The more you realize the depth of design, the more you recognize there must have been a designer. You can look at nature for that matter. The fact that every scientific principle goes forward on one basic premise, and that is whatever theory we hold true today will hold true again tomorrow. Well, how does that prove anything? If it's just a random shuffling of things, then just because it's true today doesn't mean it's going to be true tomorrow. All of science is built on the premise that will hold true today as it will tomorrow. The fact that we're able to predict things in science, for example, we know exactly when the new moon will be. We know exactly at what time. We know exactly in what position. Why? Because we have studied astronomy long enough to know what the patterns are in science. You say, yeah, but who says that it's going to hold uniform tomorrow what it did today? See, that's part of the design of the world in which we live. Einstein said that, yes, there's a certain matter of faith, that the possibility that the regulations that are valid for the world of existence, that they are rational, comprehensible to reason. Without the belief in the uniformity of nature, he said, no theoretical formula of universal character could ever be established. You have to understand the fact that the sun rises every single morning and we can do it like clockwork. We know exactly what time sunrise is because everything is uniform. The complexity of creatures all screams that there must be a designer. Things randomly to come about the way they did. Is it a possibility? The answer is yes. But every good attorney will tell you that my job is not to prove 100% because I can't do that. Nobody here in the courtroom can say that with 100% certainty. The best we can do is have a preponderance of evidence that lends support to the concept. I'm telling you, if anyone says to you that they can prove 100% that God exists, I would ask you to ask them to go see a psychologist. It can't be done. It cannot be done in our world because we live in a physical world and God is not physical. So how do we know? I think if you look at the world as one piece of evidence, it lends tremendous support. And this is one area. There are courses in college, there are courses in yeshiva and seminary that are devoted to this one question that goes on and on and on. And I feel like I'm not going to do it justice, even if I spoke for an hour, but we are limited. So suffice it for now that this is what the principle is based on. There is a God that exists. You can't prove it directly, but there is a preponderance of evidence if you open your eyes. The second aspect that Maimonides identifies, he never refers to God as God in the 13 principles. He calls him a bore, a creator. This is an important idea because the very first introduction we have to God in the Torah is through creation. Bereshit bara Elokim, in the beginning of God's creating heaven and earth. That is how he introduces himself as a creator. Now, nothing, absolutely nothing that exists in heaven, on earth, or anywhere in between derives its existence except from him. God is a creator. That's it. Nothing else exists without it. There's no independent source. In fact, one of the major beliefs that Judaism is built on is the fact that God created the world ex nihilo, something from nothing. They tell a great story about a group of scientists that had really done very well and had figured out, according to them, they had figured out how to create life. So they call all the news media, they call everybody, and they're going to have a big experiment and they're going to show the world that they know how to create life. And the story goes that that fateful day comes and they go out into the desert and all of the news cameras are there and all the media outlets are there. And of course, they're setting it up, and the experiment begins by them starting to form out of the dust of the ground, the form of a human being. And they're just about ready to do the experiment when this big booming voice from heaven comes up and says, hey, if you want to create life on your own, get your own dirt. Start with nothing. Yeah, there's truth to that. It's very nice. You can go ahead and you can create something from something. That's something God has given to humanity. But to create something from nothing, that is godly. That is one of the major beliefs about Judaism, that it is God who created the first matter from which other things were created. Absolutely. But the very beginning starts by God creating it. The creation of something from nothing. Now, it's interesting. There are two Hebrew words. Make sure I don't go over time here. There are two Hebrew words that are often interchanged, but they're not exactly. They're really not synonyms. We use the Hebrew word bara, creates, and yatsar, which means to form or to fashion. Yitzira and beria. They're often interchanged, but they really mean something very different. When you use the word bara, creates, it means ex nihilo. It means something from nothing. When you create something from already existing matter, you use the word yatsar, to form or to fashion. Now, if you have some level of knowledge of the liturgy, you might be wondering, the very first blessing right after Yishtabach, when we begin the new section right before the Shema in the Shacharit service, we start with a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Yotzer Or Uborei Choshech. Now, if you're not careful with the translation, you come up with the same. He created light and he created darkness. But the words are very different. Use the word Yotzer Or Uborei Choshech. Why is one called? One second here. Why is one of them called Bore and one called Yotzer? So if you look carefully, what you find is that Bore is creating something from nothing is associated with darkness, and Yotzer, which implies something from something, is light, which is strange. Why? I would have thought the opposite. But the truth of the matter is that if you recall your story in Bereshit, in the very beginning of creation, the very first couple of sentences tell us that God created darkness. Darkness was before light. In fact, it says, in the beginning of God creating the heavens and earth, the ha'aretz ha'tatovavo, the earth was astonishingly empty, v'choshech al p'nei tahom, and darkness was hovering upon the waters, whatever that esoteric concept means. But clearly, there was a concept of darkness already. We're under the impression that darkness is the absence of light. It is not. When God created darkness, it was a real creation, not just the absence of something else. So first God created darkness, and then afterwards it says, God said, let there be light from the already existing matter. So therefore, the bracha that we use identifies and says, Yotzer Or, he fashioned light because it's something from something. But Ubore Choshech, he created darkness. This is really an important idea. We're going to come back to this at a later date, perhaps in the fourth principle, with the idea that nothing, no angel, no spheres, nothing in the heavenly realm, nothing in the earthly realm, nothing, matter, time, nothing existed until God created it. This is part of the rule, a part of the principle that God is a creator. But I want to get to a second point quickly here. And that is, it's not just identified in this principle that God creates. He also uses the word and guides. Bore umanhig. If you've ever been on a bus in Israel and you're about to miss your stop because he's very impatient and he's closing the door, you scream out, nahag, nahag, driver, driver, hey, hey, I got to get off. The word manhig is a leader, is someone who guides. The Rambam here identifies God not just as a creator, but also as one who guides life. We believe, Judaism tells us that God did not just create the universe and let it go by itself, just letting it run according to the laws, quote unquote, of nature, but that rather God stays actively involved in the day-to-day. And we just finished celebrating the holiday that proves it, and that is the holiday of Passover. You have the Egyptians who have enslaved the Jewish people for so long. And God goes ahead and he turns their world upside down with 10 plagues, with a splitting of the sea. Everything that they thought was the norm of nature, the way it was running, was turned on its head. As soon as they finish crossing the sea and they go into the desert and they complain, what are we going to eat? God causes manna to fall from heaven. That entire Exodus experience, all the way leading up to the Sinai experience of the giving of the Torah, was showing us, as a prime example, God's profound interest in human affairs. And I'll end with this, and we'll come back, because we're not done with this principle. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at the Exodus, why do we keep Shabbos? Let's go back a second. Why do we observe the Shabbat? So most people will tell you, because it's a commemoration of creation. God worked for 6 days and he rested on the seventh. We do the same thing. However, if you read your Kiddush blessing carefully, you will find something astounding. Here's what it says. This is the blessing after the blessing on the wine or the grape juice. It says, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments, took pleasure in us, and with love and favor gave us his holy Sabbath as a heritage. Number one, a remembrance of creation. It's Zecher Lemaasei Bereshit. It's a commemoration of the fact that God created the universe. But that's not where it ends. Ki hu yom tchila, for that day, is the prologue to the holy convocations. Zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim. It's a commemoration for the exodus of Egypt. Now make up your mind. Is Shabbat there to remind us of creation, or is Shabbat there to remind us of the exodus? So the answer is both. Because if you look, there's two places in the Torah where it has the Ten Commandments. And in each of them, it makes reference to Shabbat, obviously. And in each one, they give a different reason. The first one in Parshat Yitro, it says the reason why we have Shabbat is to remember the creation. And then later in Parshat Ve'et Chanan, in the book of Devarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, it has it as the reason of Zecher Liyitziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus from Egypt. Because the truth of the matter is that is the fundamental belief of Judaism. We believe that God created a universe and also stayed involved with it. The Shabbos Kiddush is the combination of both. We will continue with this tomorrow. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to stay on to see if anything piqued your interest.
Rabbi T.
Yes.
When he says that God creates and guides, was the clockmaker theory existent at his time? Is he like actively trying to disprove that?
I missed the beginning of the question. Say it again. I'm sorry.
When he says God creates and guides, was he like actively trying to disprove the clockmaker theory? Like, was there something he was combating writing the 13 principles?
It's possible. It's certainly possible. I don't know. I don't know what was in his mind. I do know that he chose his words purposely to stress that both aspects are fundamental to our belief. Whether it was as a counter to something of his time that people were suggesting, it could be. That I don't know.
Thank you.
Where was he when he wrote these?
I'm sorry?
Where was he when he wrote these?
He started writing them when he was in Spain. He was born in Spain, and he was there through probably his early 20s. And then he had to move. He was born in Cordova. And then he had to travel. He moved. At one point, he made it into Morocco. And then by the time, I don't know exactly at what age he got into Egypt, but at age 30, he was certainly there when he finished and actually published this. I should clarify, he didn't just publish these 13 principles. Again, this was part of his fantastic commentary on the entire set of Mishnah, the six orders of Mishnah. This was one particular introduction to a chapter in the tractate Sanhedrin. It was just an introductory commentary, because there it talks about some of the principles of Judaism, and he wrote this all as a commentary to it.
Rabbi Tzvi, Robert Edelman here.
Hi, Doc.
Hi. I want to make a comment on your opening comment that science, the theories developed by science are here today and tomorrow. They're permanent. If that's what you said, that's not that. Then I misunderstood what you said.
If I said it that way, I apologize. What I meant to say is that scientific principles work on the theory that if it's something true today, it should hold true tomorrow. It may or may not, and therefore the theory can be thrown away. However, the fact that you can move forward on such a premise means that there's a uniformity of nature that you can rely on. That is an indication that there was a design to this. It wasn't just random. I didn't mean to suggest that science is automatically held true any day.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for giving me the chance to clarify. Okay. Great. Thank you all for joining. We will see you here hopefully tomorrow night at 7:45.
Thank you.
Have a great night, everyone.
Bye-bye.